episode of We the People Radio.
There you are.
My name's Aaron Ryan.
And my name's Bill Cundy.
I just wanted to see if you got in front of me.
No.
I couldn't make you talk by staring at you, just like burning you with my eyes.
No, no. I'm immune. I'm immune to your buffoonery.
Immune to my eye burning?
Yes. Hey, our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake. And they're everything John Deere. You want tractors, mowers, implements, service, parts. They do it all up there. Go up and see them or give them a call. Phone number is 530-226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da.
There you go.
Let's see. Free advertisement of the day. Let's split it. Split it between Robinette's Automotive over on Hartnell. No. Yes. Hartnell?
Yeah, they're on Hartnell.
Yeah, Hartnell. Right, kind of near the Holiday and the tire shop across the parking lot.
Yeah, USA Tire.
Yep.
Yeah,
they work really well together. You go get the tires. They decide you need a alignment. They'll run it right across the parking lot for you. They're both really nice, and they both do a good job. So, there you have it.
Yeah.
Two free ads for the day. If you want free ads for the day, you should just do fun things or call us or send us email. You can find that all at We the People Radio.
We might just hook you up.
.us. We'll send people who hate the government to do business with you. But you know what? The really good part about people who hate the government's a strong word. We don't have to hate the government. But if you dislike them or dislike their policies, you're even more judicious about how you spend your money. And so I guess that's why I kind of like the free advertising of the day, because we've all got to do stuff. Buy tires, get our cars aligned, you know, get your mower fixed. There's tons of stuff you got to do. If you got to buy a new bed, get a Sleep Number. They're super nice. I mean, I don't know. We got pretty tight with our money a long time ago. We decided we weren't giving it to people we didn't like, who didn't support the things we agree with. There you go. Problem solved. Starve them out. So.
My.
Yeah, what do I really think?
Yeah.
No, I'm feeling really, really shy today. I am. I started out that way. I'm going to blame my upbringing. So our guest, William Walter Kay, I should say that without running it all together, William Walter Kay. There we go. After this, we'll call him William. He has a BA in English. Got that in 1982. Gosh, we were right around the same time. I got my degree in English around 1984-ish, 5-ish. And a law degree in 1985. Yeah, I didn't do that. My dad wanted me to, but I knew more. Bad choice. After briefly practicing law, we never got into that. Maybe we should have him tell us why he only did that briefly. He went on to establish small businesses and nonprofits. He's written two books, The Green Swastika, The Third Reich, and Environmentalism in the Third Reich. And I'll tell you what, all of his environmental stuff is fantastic. That was actually how we met. And, hey, William, why did you drop your site is down now, right? Your environmentalism
yes,
is fascism?
I
clicked
why
on it.
So,
I clicked on it a while back, and I was like, oh, wait a minute. It's not here anymore. I better take that off the page. What happened to it anyway?
Oh, I made a conscious decision to that. I mean, I was having real problems with my service provider, and that was part of it. Plus, there were some things on there that I sort of wanted to distance myself from, and he was having a hard time editing things. And I didn't want to fall into the hole of just being a blogger. I was trying to transfer into someone who got things published on other people's websites. It's almost a trap if you're just sort of hollering down the rain barrels. You know, putting stuff on your own website and trying to get other people to read that. So it was in many ways an improvement for me. It forced me to sort of write things that other people were willing to post. And since then, I've probably posted 100 articles on other people's websites. These days, I really hate the fact, you know, if I do a lot of what I consider to be good writing and I can't get other websites to post it, that is frustrating. And I never want to be a panderer. Someone who's writing things just because I think some website is going to put it up. But so I'm tempted to go back to creating another blog and doing both again. But it's a bit of a trap just being a blogger. And that's all that basic website was. It had its following for sure. And there was a lot of things I put on there that simply wouldn't be posted anywhere else. A lot of the book reviews and that. But some of those postings were 70 pages long. And I don't think a lot of people were really plowing right through them. There was a few sort of the core sort of constituency of people that were. But I don't fully regret it. And, you know, every now and then you make a breakthrough. Like, for a while, antiwar.com seemed to be blackballing me. They were posting my stuff. But I just got an email this morning that they are going to post my day 150, which is kind of a breakthrough again, because I thought I was actually developing a conspiracy theory about them, that they were, you know, deliberately avoiding certain truths about the Ukrainian war. But got an email to be like, groups like the Canada Free Press, and there's a few other ones that fairly regularly post my stuff now. But I'm always, I don't make enough of an effort to get to a wider audience of web zines out there. There's quite a few, but can't handle the rejection, you know.
Yeah.
I've been posted on American Thinker and on, you know, the Ron Paul Institute and a whole bunch of these sort of things from time to time. But, you know, they, quite often you'll write things and send it to them. They don't even say, no, we don't want it. You don't even hear back from them, and that can be kind of frustrating. So
yeah,
I don't want to get sort of pigeonholed with a few sort of web zines, but yeah, there's something to be said for getting someone else to post it and not simply being a blogger.
Well,
but
I just...
There were some things that I posted on ecofascism.com. Like, you know, yeah, I had that website up for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I really needed to edit it because I was looking back at some of the earlier posts and, you know, I think, you know, some of the language I was using, particularly with regard to the Canadian Aboriginal movement, I was just being a little too sarcastic and snippy, and not that I am in any way a supporter of that movement, but some of that stuff really needed to get pulled off, and I have this incompetent service provider who had lost a lot of the codes and lost the ability to edit the website.
Oh.
And I, being a techno-Neanderthal, couldn't do it myself. So that was also part of the problem.
Well, it's hard to get somebody else to read your mind. I mean, that that does pose problems. You used to do radio, too. I remember when we first met you a long time ago. Let's see, back in 2011. God, can you believe that? It's been that long ago. Back in 2011, you had, I think, pretty recently dropped your radio program because it was primarily on...
Oh, I was kicked off the air. Let's be perfectly clear.
Oh, okay.
That. And that would have happened several years before that, when we first started to interact. I did a weekly radio show on a station in Vancouver, British Columbia, CFRO, which was a co-op station. That was actually quite a big station. It reached probably 3 million on audio, like a service area of 3 million people, definitely Washington State as well. So it was a very popular show, but I was interviewing a lot of climate skeptics and enviro skeptics, and this led to a concerted 2-year campaign to kick me off the air. There were full-page articles about it in the Vancouver Sun newspaper, but, you know, the bastards do eventually grind you down. They took over the entire station.
Oh.
To get me off the air. There was the one AGM, I knew they were trying to do this, and I put out the call, and a lot of my friends and supporters came out, and we managed to get enough friends on the board to prevent my show getting kicked off the air. But, you know, they grind you down, and the next AGM, man, they, you know, they really pulled out the stops. There's a group called the British Columbia Environmental Network, which operates as a hub for local environmental groups, which employ thousands of people. And they got one of their people to become the program coordinator for the station, which appeared to be a volunteer gig, but she was a full-time salaried staff member of the BC Environmental Network the whole time that she was pretending to be a volunteer program coordinator. And she was actively soliciting people to write letters and send emails to get me off the air. And then they had another AGM, and they just packed the hall with environmentalists. And they took over the board, and the next day later, my show was on. It was Friday noon hour show. I went on the air, and I just told everybody, hey, this show is getting canceled. They've just taken over the board. Like, you know, I explained that I'd gotten in trouble before the previous AGM, because I did the same thing. And they said, you know, you shouldn't be discussing station politics on the air like that. But
too late.
This time around, I did it again. Definitely got booted off the air. And the pretext was that I talked about station politics on the air. But I knew for a fact that was going to be the last show. And so I'm glad I didn't. And I had friends say, well, you shouldn't have been talking about station politics on the air. BS.
Yeah.
It was over. And what would have happened, it just would have been silent. There would have been another show. What they did is they replaced my show with this bogus canned show from some station called Pacifica in San Francisco. But it wasn't even a local broadcaster. It was just some canned show from Pacifica, you know, green to the gills, nonsense, you know, have it their way, you know. That's what it is. But it certainly, you know, got a lot of ears while it was on the air. I had that show for several years. I really liked doing it, but there's no point doing something like what you're doing if you're just going to be putting out someone else's lies. I mean, why even bother?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it does sort of miss the mark if you can't. Say what you really think. And it's interesting because I always figured with our program a long time ago when we first started, I thought, well, if people don't like it, they can change the channel. It's not that hard. It isn't like you have a captive audience of any kind. It's unfortunate that, people are intolerant. I'm not even going to lay it at the feet on one side or the other, but I was curious about that. I was reading your thing today, and I thought, we're going to talk about war today. I thought, you should find out what happened what happened in your previous battle.
The Enviro Wars of British Columbia, yeah.
Yeah, unbelievable. So, let's see, we've got like 3 minutes before the break. Why don't you... I don't know how you want to tackle this topic today, so it's kind of up to you how you want to do it.
Well, my most recent article is Day 150 of the Russo-Ukrainian War. What I've been doing as a sideline since the war started, in fact, 3 weeks before the war started, is I make sure that I spend at least an hour a day reading the Russian press. You know, what kind of a judge would you be if you just listened to one side of the case? What kind of a journalist are you if all you're going to do is repeat the war propaganda from your side? So I really made a point of reading their side of the case and, you know, scouring the Internet for alternative opinions. I'm still, you know, I even go to the Ukrainian national websites and what have you. So I'm trying to get a very balanced perspective of it. I did an article. I've done four articles now on the Russo-Ukrainian war. They are quite popular. But I'm definitely of the view that the Russians are describing the war far more accurately and honestly than what we're getting through the mainstream media. And the bottom line is this war is a slaughterhouse. It is very one-sided. Scott Ritter put the body count at about 20 to 1. That's probably an underestimation. It's probably more like 25 or 30 to 1. Ukrainians dying for every Russian or Russian ally that's dying. It's the Russians, and this could be demonstrably proved through common sense. The Ukrainians do not have an effective air force. The Russian air force, by anyone's standard, is the second most powerful air force in the world. This war is not occurring on the other side of the planet like Americans fighting Iraq. This war is occurring right on Russia's border, and they are launching thousands of cruise missile strikes onto Ukrainian positions. They're blasting their munitions warehouses. They're blasting their army barracks. They also, their navy did not survive day one of this war. And the Russians have their Black Sea fleet right along the coast. Ukraine, or what was Ukraine, did have a 2,700-kilometer coastline. It's to put you into perspective, that's almost twice as long as California's coastline. So if you imagine California is at war and you don't have a navy, and there's dozens of missile frigates and missile submarines prowling your coast, freely firing missiles into your territory, and you don't have the capacity to intercept those missiles. That's what this war is like. And in the front line, the artillery duel, once again, very one-sided, and the Ukrainians are just being massacred. The best estimates of about 2 weeks ago were 50,000 Ukrainian dead, 150,000 wounded. I would say it's probably now in the neighborhood of, you know, 60 to 65,000 dead, pushing to upwards of 200,000 wounded. It is just a slaughterhouse, and it's not going to go on. The Biden administration has effectively captured the Ukrainian government. They have outlawed almost every political party, including the main opposition party. They have nationalized and centralized all the media in Ukraine. They have drafted 1 million soldiers. They plan to draft 2 million more. They've got enlistment officers standing up front of the churches on Sunday to grab what appear to be draftable men as they leave the church. They're sweeping the bars. They're sweeping the beaches, grabbing people, forcing them into army barracks, where they're given 2 weeks of training, and then they're put out to this front line, which is basically a giant wood chipper. That's what's happening in this war right now.
Yikes. On that note, take a quick break. I'm not sure if you want to go over the caffeinated stuff. Probably time to move early into the decaf zone. You are listening to We the People. We'll be back with our guest, William Kay. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them? When they move into your neighborhood, they take over but good. They want you all body and soul.
Don Henley was way ahead of his time. Or maybe I should say he's just timeless.
You know, William, I'm sure I'm not alone, but it's never made sense to me how Ukraine is this gladiator that holds Russia off and advances on their territory, and, you know, they're winning this thing. It can't be sustained, and I've always questioned that, and it sounds like we were right.
It's a big lie. I'll tell you one of the parts of the big lie that I find particularly maddening. When the war started, like, you can debate when the actual war started. It was, to the people who live in Donbass, the war started 8 years ago. But on February the 24th, when the Russians became involved in a major way, day one, they took out 800 targets with missiles. But you will recall that they made this move towards Kiev, and they made this move towards Kharkiv, which is another large city in northern Ukraine. It came over the Belarusian border. And there was a 30 to 40 day period where it looked like the Russians were actually going to attack Kiev. And then they suddenly pulled out, and they went around back through Belarus and back to where the main action was in eastern Ukraine. That, in military terminology, is known as a feint. It's known as a ruse. You look like you're going to attack something, but then you don't. You go and attack something else. While that was going on, the really heavy ground fighting was taking place in the very southern part of the Donbass in Mariupol, which was a city of around 350,000 people. And the Russians and their allies devoted a full division, over 15,000 crack troops. It's a coastal city. The Russian fleet was anchored right off coast. They were also firing onto the city. And it still took them, you know, 90 days to fully capture that city, although they'd more or less cornered them into a steel plant for the last 30 days where they hid behind women and children and saved themselves that way. Point is this. Kiev has a population of over 3 million. The Russians never had more than 10,000 troops to the north of Kiev. They never had anywhere near enough troops. It took them over 15,000 troops in rotation to capture Mariupol. They would have had to have over 100,000 troops and then some to capture Kiev. But they pull it into north of those two cities, and then they take off a month later. That is being treated in the media as the Ukrainians beating the Russians back, driving them away from the gates of Kiev. No, it was clearly a ruse. They never had the capacity or intention to actually take those cities. It worked for a while. For about a week or two there, it looked to me as though they were actually attacking Kiev. Then it became clear that they weren't even trying to surround Kiev. And the Western media started saying, well, they're sure behaving weird. I mean, they're just sort of sitting there. They're not doing anything. And then they took off, went around this big sort of semicircle, and it engaged the front line on Donbass from the north. But there's barely a Western media or a mainstream media commentator that doesn't talk about this great victory that was achieved north of Kiev. The only, when the Ukrainians retook that territory, there wasn't a single Russian soldier left there. They had completely abandoned those farmers' fields and villages into Belarus. Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, 2 days ago reiterates this lie about how the heroic Ukrainians had driven the Russians away from Kiev, and that Putin's original plan was to overrun Kiev and change the regime in Ukraine. Now, that's a complete mythology. The fact is, Ukrainians have not captured a square yard of territory in this whole war.
Yeah.
I think we should just drop back a bit and give the listeners just a bit of a background.
Sure.
Ukraine is sort of this egg-shaped country, which is, of course, Ukrainians are really big into painted eggs. I know this because I'm in Canada, and there's huge numbers of Ukrainians here, and they all paint eggs in colorful ways, and they have statues of painted eggs as well. Anyway, the eastern portion of Ukraine, which borders Russia, whereas in the United States you have states of the Union, you have 50 states of the Union. In Canada we have provinces, we have 10 provinces. In Ukraine they're called oblasts. They're not called states or provinces, they're called oblasts. The two easternmost oblasts of Ukraine, the two easternmost states, have populations that are majority Russian-speaking, Russian self-identifying people. Before the war, over a quarter of the population of Ukraine were not ethnic Ukrainians. They did not speak Ukrainian. Even a lot of the ethnic Ukrainians did not speak Ukrainian. They spoke Russian. And due to the Obama administration's fascist coup d'etat in 2014, when you had Hillary Clinton and McCain out there handing out cookies to the massive mob out front of the parliament and paying everyone in that mob $100 a day to be there, which was more than a journeyman makes in Kiev. They overthrow the government in Kiev. That government was led by a guy called Viktor Yanukovych, who was from the Donbass. He was from the majority Russian area. He himself was not Russian. He was from Polish-Lithuanian background, but he'd grown up in the Donbass. Throughout that whole region, you're going to find people who are Romanian, Polish, and Bulgarian, whatever. You know, there's a lot of people of mixed identity. But after the 2014 coup, sort of these Ukrainian ultra-nationalists, Ukrainian Nazis, what have you, were becoming increasingly prominent, and they really had a lot of rhetoric and a vision of Ukraine as a pure ethnic state, ethno state, and that they really had a harsh attitude towards the minorities of all types. And of course, in those two eastern oblasts or provinces, the population was majority Russian. So after the 2014 coup, those two states declared independence because they were strong supporters of Viktor Yanukovych, and it was clear that after the coup d'etat that their votes didn't matter, that they were not being represented in Kiev, so they declared independence in 2014. Then the government in Kiev tried to retake those two states by force. You had a civil war starting in 2014, and they failed to do so. They recaptured about half of the territory of those two states. One's called Donetsk in the south, and one's called Luhansk. The overall area of those is referred to as the Donbass. And the Ukrainian government recaptured about half of the territory, the less populated half of the territory, and that's where things were stuck. And ultimately, they created a peace deal. You know, intervention by the French and the Germans and the Belarusians created a peace deal along the front line, which was called the line of contact. And they were supposed to pull back your heavy weapons from along the line of contact. You're not supposed to shoot howitzers across the line, etc. And things more or less sat there for about 8 years. It was all kinds of violations. But on the Ukrainian side, what you found were these neo-Nazi battalions like the Azov Battalion, Aiden Battalion. There were several of them. They were just terrorizing the local population. and a million Russian identifying, self-identifying Ukrainian citizens fled that area, fled the area of the Donbass that was controlled by the Ukrainian government, because there was, you know, death squads and terrorists and all kinds of intimidation and bullying going on. It was an ethnic cleansing campaign was going on in the half of the Donbass that was controlled by the Ukrainian government. And over a few years, those neo-Nazi battalions were fully integrated into the Ukrainian armed forces. During the Trump administration, things were sort of at a lukewarm simmer. As soon as Biden gets back in, those forces, Ukraine then mobilizes 125,000 soldiers along that line of contact. Of those, at least 25,000 were members of these neo-Nazi groups that openly flew Nazi regalia. They had swastika tattoos, the whole nine yards. The rhetoric was all about Russians being subhumans, even though reality is there is no ethnic difference between, a racial difference between a Ukrainian and a Russian, although them is fighting word. Their languages aren't even that different. But these guys had this real sort of anti-Russian mentality, and it looked very much like they were planning to go right across the line of contact and drive out all of the Russian people from the eastern part of the Donbass. So the Russians started to mobilize their forces on Russian territory, just on the eastern side of the Donbass, and they also started to mobilize in the south and the north. In the couple of weeks leading up to this, because Biden has given them the green light, the Ukraine has given them the green light to physically take over the full Donbass, which would have been a nightmare for the people who were living there. There was about 10 days or so before February 24th where Ukraine would start firing just randomly howitzer shells into the cities and towns of the eastern Donbass. They had commandos going across, blowing up electrical installations and things like that. That is when the Russians intervened. They intervened. They, from their point of view, their hands were forced. According to the Russian foreign ministry, we were just not going to sit there and watch this go on. I mean, they were physically driving these people out of this area. There was an ethnic cleansing operation going on. And we simply couldn't tolerate. The capital city of Donetsk is called Donetsk, population over 1 million. The front line was, you know, 5 miles outside of town, and the Ukrainians were blasting mortars and rockets and howitzer shells right into the civilian population. This provoked the Russians into doing what they did. I think the Ukrainians were hoping the Russians were going to put their heads down and run straight, you know, east to west right into the front line, because they had fortified the front lines with concrete firing positions. They had laid mines, like 1,000 mines per square mile along that area. But the Russians didn't do that. They attacked from the north and the south. They attacked all of Ukraine, not just the front line. And, of course, this was the pretext for all the sanctions and all the hand-wringing and gnashing of teeth that occurred after that. But that was what occurred in the lead-up to the war.
So it wasn't the threat of joining NATO. Wasn't the threat of joining
that
NATO.
That was also a big part of it. The Russians had four demands into this. Demand number one was that Ukraine had to surrender, relinquish any rights to the Donbass, those two oblasts, Donetsk and Luhansk. Ukraine had to agree not to join NATO and agree not to station nuclear weapons on their territory. Those latter two requests, that was the status quo. Ukraine is not a member of NATO. Putin said you can join the European Union if you want, but you cannot join NATO and then start positioning nuclear weapons right along our border like this, you know, whatever, hundreds of miles from Moscow. The NATO thing was definitely a core demand of the Russians, but in terms of land, it's also a core demand that Ukraine has to surrender their claim to the Donbass region, to Donetsk and Luhansk. And the war has been grinding on right now. The Russians and their allies have retaken all of Luhansk and probably 70% of Donetsk. But they're moving at this glacial speed. But at the same time, they've captured a lot of additional territory in southern Ukraine. That is, I can't remember what the question was. We got into this. But that's more or less the run-up to it. But, yeah, you're right. Definitely the NATO issue, front and center. It is inacceptable to the Russians that Ukraine would be a member of NATO and that they would be stationing these long-range weapons right along their border. That is unacceptable. When the Cold War ended, it was the Russians' understanding that NATO would not expand eastward, but boy, did it ever. And their line in the sand is definitely the Ukraine. They are not going to allow that to become a NATO state and to become a nuclear missile base. Period. Mm. Definitely part of the equation. But once again, that demand is the status quo. That is, that would cost the Ukrainians nothing to agree to that. And even Zelensky has said that to effect that, you know, maybe joining NATO, you know, that's debatable. We can negotiate that. Although he's completely stopped talking about negotiations now. There's the hallucinatory rhetoric coming out of the Ukrainian government in air quotes, you know, about how they're going to drive the Russians out of Ukraine, drive the Russians out of Crimea, and sink the Black Sea fleet. They're not interested at all in negotiations now. The more they become a subsidiary of NATO, the more belligerent they're becoming.
Yeah, it's interesting. They couldn't overtake those two states with their military, but they're able to beat back the Russian army from invading their country. It just doesn't make sense, you know, that reporting.
Well, what really puts the lie to it, you know, if anyone spent an evening just, you know, reading about the Russian Air Force, the Russian Navy, just the scale of it, they've got in service 1,100 fighter jets, in service 137 strategic bombers. I read a lot about, you know, I write a lot about, you know, their cruise missiles and their short-range ballistic missiles and a lot of other equipment. This stuff, you know, it's always never quite as good as the Americans, but the Russians sort of have a genius for doing things on the cheap. And some of their stuff, you know, is really low-cost but highly effective weapons. But they are just blasting that country with cruise missiles pretty much at will. And they've penetrated completely Ukrainian intelligence. That's why I was working on that article about the day 150. I was doing that, and that's when that attack in Vinnytsia happened. And I just couldn't resist but write a small article about that, just to set it up to you about just the scale to which the Russians have penetrated Ukrainian intelligence. The Ukrainians had decided they were going to hold a top-secret meeting to deal with their major problem in this war, and that is they lack proper air defenses and they no longer have an air force. So they either decided to have a meeting in a remote provincial city called Vinnytsia, which is about 200 miles west of Kiev. At the meeting were going to be their entire Air Force high command, and they were going to be meeting with several representatives of major Western weapons dealers, and the number one agenda of the meeting is how do we shore up our missile defense system so we can start knocking out some of these cruise missiles, and how do we go about overhauling and reestablishing some sort of Ukrainian air force. The meeting starts at 10 a.m. at this Veterans Hall in Vinnytsia. At 10:40, it gets hit with three cruise missiles, kill everyone in the meeting, their entire Air Force high command. This happened 10 days ago. The Russians immediately put out a statement saying that they have done this, and they knew the date of the meeting, they knew the time of the meeting, they knew everybody who was in attendance at the meeting, and they knew what the meeting's agenda was. And then they killed everybody in the meeting. And so Zelensky immediately fires his head of counterintelligence, who was a childhood friend of his. He fires his, what would be the equivalent of his head of the Department of Justice. He issues a communique that, you know, since this war has started, they have launched 600 prosecutions against members of both of their departments, the Department of Justice and what's the equivalent of their FBI. And they still haven't rooted out all the Russian agents and collaborators inside those organizations.
Wow.
When the war started, 60 members, it's called the SBU, it's the successor to the Ukrainian KGB.
Hold that thought, William, because I don't want to shortcut that. Let's come back with that.
Sure.
This is a big topic. Okay, so you are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
That dancing girl is making eyes at me.
I'm sure she's working for the KGB in this paradise. Ah, cold as ice.
Was dying out. No one left to scream and shout. Evo walking on the moon. Smog will get you pretty soon. Evo one was hanging out. Hanging up and hanging down.
Thought playing Ship of Fools seemed appropriate.
Jim Morrison.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Little Ship of Fools there. So, okay, go back to where the spies are coming from, the origin of the spies.
Well, the SBU is sort of a fusion of what you would call the FBI and the CIA in the United States. It was formerly the Ukrainian branch of the KGB. After Ukraine got independence from the Soviet Union, it's sort of there. Its buildings are still there. And it became a counterintelligence, foreign intelligence bureau of the Ukrainian government. At the outset of this war, 60 of their officers, including colonels, fled to the Russian side, took all their codes, passwords with them. They probably didn't even need all of that. There's a Russian hacking group, which are clearly integrated into Russian military intelligence. About a week ago, they posted this thing saying that at the outset of this war, we had identified 721 Ukrainian government internet portals. We have fully hacked and accessed every one. They had done that at the day one of the war. They had already done that. And there was an article saying, why did the Russians stop cyber attacks during this war? Why? Because they're just harvesting all this information, like from the health department, from the highway department. They have complete access to all that information. Plus, they've got all these people who have joined them. They were formerly high-ranking officials of the SBU. After they blew up that building in Venezia, where the meeting of their entire Air Force High Command just got killed, and probably some American weapons dealers got killed, but we haven't heard much about that. What we also never heard about was within hours of that attack, the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine, great website, I must say, they issued a bulletin saying that all American citizens should immediately leave Ukraine. You can find that. It's like July 14th. Go to the U.S. Embassy Ukraine website. That was never mentioned in any major American news media. But there was a direct bulletin, all Americans immediately leave this country. Because the Russians, after they blasted that office block, said that they are now going to target intelligence buildings all across the Ukraine. And about 2 days later, they struck 9 offices of the SBU in one day. So they're going downtown now and blowing up what would be like FBI offices. They're hitting them with missiles.
Mm-hmm.
So they're completely undermining their counterintelligence. So not only do they have hackers that have fully penetrated the Ukrainian internet system, they've got planes flying around that are intercepting all the over-air communication. One gem from that was early on in the war, there were 200 British mercenaries in an army barracks just off the city of Lvov, which is the very westernmost part of Ukraine. It borders on Poland. There was an army compound there, and in that compound were 200 recently arrived British mercenaries. It got hit in the middle of the night with 30 cruise missiles.
Oh,
missiles were fired from Russian airspace on the eastern side. They're just showing off their cruise missile capabilities. But how did the Russians know that these guys were in that particular building? because they were all phoning home to England at the same time. They were all sending selfies to mom at the same time. They were all sending selfies back to their buddies in the pub. I went, wow, I'm in Ukraine now. Look at this. And the Russians were intercepting all these phone calls, and they could triangulate back to exactly where they were coming from.
Wow.
So these guys were bragging about how we've made it to Ukraine. They don't know if there's cruise missiles coming their way. The
Jeez.
Russians initially said they killed everybody in the building, but some of them actually survived. The ones that survived said there were 60 seconds elapsed between the air raid siren going off and the cruise missiles coming through the wall. So either you just ran naked out the door or you died. And about 2 days later, they've hit about 40 barracks that have foreign fighters in them. They've got a particular hate on for foreign mercenaries, foreign fighters getting involved in that. They do not believe they are in any way protected by the laws of war. They blew up another one much closer to the front line. Killed 200 foreign fighters. The next day, there was a video released of the Ukrainian commanders and some of the foreign fighters, commanding officers, who weren't in the building standing there, and they just had this shocked look on their face. And one of the commentators said, who did you think you came to fight, the Taliban? I mean, these people had no idea, who you're actually fighting. You're fighting an Air Force, an aerospace force, that can definitely put a cruise missile down on any building in the Ukraine, at will. Mm-hmm. And they have hit, I don't know, probably hundreds of army barracks.
Yeah.
But,
well, they've obviously got a intelligence issue, a security issue. But, you know, speaking of that, it just brought to mind, prior to the war, we did a lot of business with Ukraine. I mean, gosh, look at all the products we have on our shelves that are made in Ukraine. But that country, and, you know, after the war started, it was this fabulous democracy that is being attacked. And it's a horrible thing, don't get me wrong. I mean, a lot of innocent people are getting killed. But the Ukrainian government aren't choir boys. There was a lot of corruption in that country prior to the war, and it I guess you could loosely call it a democracy, but am I on target there?
Well, I thought, to my mind, they lost any claim to democracy after the 2014 coup. That was a violent overthrow of the government. It was orchestrated by the American government. Victoria Nuland and the Obama administration did that. To my mind, they lose any claim to democracy, but corruption even before then was rampant.
Right.
It's a kleptocracy. That's why Hunter Biden was so popular there. There's a Dutch academic group that does reports on international criminal syndicates, and they placed Ukraine as the second greatest hub of illegal weapons transactions. I think there's a place south in Peshawar, Pakistan, just south of the Afghanistan border. That's the worst place in the world. You can buy anything you want. They're like Stinger missiles, whatever. But Ukraine was number two, notorious for illegal black market sales.
Well, that...
You know, Biden's idea of giving them billions of dollars of shoulder-fired anti-tank weapons, which are already appearing. The Swiss police have arrested gangs, like biker gangs, with some of these weapons that the Americans have sent to Ukrainians. They're all over the dark net. They're selling these things.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to haunt the world for a long time to come. I think they've given them 8,000 Stinger anti-aircraft missiles. Those are on the dark net. The Russians are buying howitzers from them, from the Ukrainians.
Yeah.
And what schooled me was I was expecting something like, you know, a shoulder-fired anti-tank weapon. On the black market, you would get more money for it than, you know, than a government would normally pay or the cost of production. No, they're selling these things for peanuts. The Russians bought two self-propelled howitzers manufactured in France. Manufacturing cost over $7 million. They bought them for $100,000. They paid 2 cents on the dollar. And a lot of these, you know, anti-tank weapons, they're being sold for $1,000 online.
Yeah.
They busted one Ukrainian soldier. He had hundreds of rocket-propelled grenades, crates of them, and he was asking for $2,000.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, that's what I mean. There was just tons of corruption that goes on in that country. There were, I read an article here a while back that they were a major hub for child pornography. They were a hub for human trafficking.
Definitely.
I mean, all that was going on while we were doing business with them, and it was quiet. And the minute they got attacked by Russia, they were this shining star on the hill. And I mean, that we got to get that record straight.
It's just propaganda. No, it's a kleptocracy. It's always had a serious problem with that. As in a lot of the post-Soviet regime, what you had is a lot of state-owned enterprises, and they broke them up into private enterprises, but there was a huge amount of graft. Like a lot of these oligarchs and billionaires, all these guys were, a lot of them were former Communist Party members. They were members of criminal gangs. But when they broke up and sold off a lot of these state-owned enterprises, and these included things like steel yards and natural gas fields, functioning natural gas fields, suddenly some guys, that's his private assets now. He's some real entrepreneur. You know, they're coming into possession of this. Hunter Biden was directly involved in that nonsense. It was a lot of natural gas fields in central western Ukraine that went from state property to private ownership, and there was a whole, bunch of mafia cliques that were grabbing control of these things in sort of dark ways.
Right.
He was involved in that.
Well,
that's another.
There was an article, I can't remember where I was reading it, but I think the title of the article was "Weapons Going to Ukraine, Who's Getting Them, and Where Are They Going?" And it's exactly what you were just saying.
Now, there's an article in the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the Canadian government, we're handing out billions of dollars to this government. We're not keeping track of anything.
No.
The moment it goes into Ukraine, where does it go? Who knows? RT had this article just showing clips from the dark net of all the stuff, all this American-made military hardware being offered for sale. Like, here it is, Stinger anti-aircraft missile, $1,500.
That's incredible.
You know, it's really dangerous because people could be shooting commercial airliners out of the sky with those things.
Sure.
If you get them landing or, taking off. So it's the last sort of thing you want to be, circulating around in the criminal underworld and the terrorist underworld of those kinds of weapons. And the people that we're giving to simply cannot be trusted. This is a deeply corrupt. And the articles you read is the corruption goes all the way to the bottom. You know, you expect it to be at the top, but one guy, the reporter, was talking to a taxi driver not far from the front line, and what he was doing was driving to the front line, exchanging pot, marijuana, for crates of ammunition. Like, these are the front line soldiers that are coming out with a crate of ammunition, and they'll do that for a bag of pot.
Yeah, and then the story we hear on our side is we need to get them more ammunition.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The Americans on July the 4th gave them 59 million rifle rounds.
Right.
I wonder, who are going to maybe go to the Ukraine embassy, U.S. embassy in Ukraine website, go to their July 4th posting. They list this manifest of like 40 different types of weapons that they're giving them. They're just dumping it out. It's over $8 billion in weapons. And you can bet that the Biden crime family is getting their nickel off every transaction there. And a lot of this stuff, like just thousands upon thousands of anti-aircraft, shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles, shoulder-fired anti-tank weaponry. That is just the last stuff you want to see circulating around.
Oh, yeah.
To repeat, the criminal terrorist underworld. And that's who these people are going to sell it to. Those weapons are practically useless in this war because the Russians are relying very heavily on howitzers, long-range howitzers, on these really cheap little eye-in-the-sky drones. They're also relying a lot on very high-altitude cruise missile launches, submarine cruise missile launches. So initially the thought was give the Ukrainians all this sort of front-line infantry anti-armor weaponry. That war is not the war they're fighting at all. They're not seeing the Russians that are hitting them. The Russians are hitting them from 20 miles away, from 500 miles away.
Uh-oh. We're into the last 10 seconds. We'll be back with William Walter Kay in the next hour. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
face that we hide away forever, and we take them out and show ourselves when everyone has gone. Some are satin, some are steel, some are silk and some are leather. They're the faces of a stranger, but we love to try them.